This episode of Hodinkee Radio is proudly brought to you by the Hodinkee Shop and our impressive collection of the latest and greatest from Zenith watches, including the sporty and historic Chronomaster Revival El Primero A385. Stay tuned for more information or visit shop.hodinkee.com to view the entire Zenith collection. Hey, it's me, James Stacy, and this past week we at Hodinkee covered two rather different takes on an outdoorsy sports watch, and I wanted to dig a little further as both are a point of personal curiosity for yours truly. So, with the goal of exploring these new watches and navigating their disparate places in the market, I asked John and Cole to jump on a call and chat about the latest generation of the iconic Rolex Explorer 2 and the rakishly charming Marathon Navigator. And as with many things in life, you know, it all comes down to details. In some cases, just a millimeter of change can make a considerable difference. So let's get into it. John, Cole, welcome back to the show.
Hey, good to be here.
It's good to see you, John. It's been a little while.
Yeah, John's been busy.
Yeah, just back from a little paternity leave.
Yeah, congratulations, of course.
Yeah, likewise.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
You're looking forward to meet the tyke at some point.
Yeah. I can't wait to introduce little Ollie to all you guys. Yeah, it's been great.
Well, that's fantastic. And like Cole said, it's great to see your face, John. It's great to have you back. I'm glad that you got the time away to do the stuff with the fam, but we've got watches to talk about.
Absolutely.
And the fun thing is this is a watch that I feel very delayed in finally being able to ask some questions about, because it came out in April of this past year. So we're talking like, you know, several months ago. And you saw it a little while ago. This is the brand new Rolex Explorer 2. The 226570 is the reference. I'm a huge Explorer 2 head. Some of my favorite Rolexes are from the lineage of that one. And the interesting thing is, like, this is one of those sneaky Rolex releases that looks almost identical, but is actually they've really changed a handful of little elements. And I know so much of it. This is kind of like I've seen the trailer and I've looked at the poster, but I haven't seen the movie. And John, you got a chance to actually see the movie. Have you owned an Explorer 2 in the past? Have you had any substantial time with any other reference?
You know, it's interesting. I have not. And I've never, you know, gone hands-on with any Explorer 2 for more than just a few minutes at a time. Yeah. And in fact, I mean, to me, like, you are the Explorer 2 guy. When I think of you, James, I think of the Explorer 2. That's the watch that I identify with you more than any other. But I'm not really an Explorer 2 guy. So I came at it with kind of like a clear head, I would get, or clear mind in terms of like a blank slate, basically.
But certainly you're well versed in the world of Rolex GMTs. You, as also with Cole, who we have on the show, of course, are both real modern, like, six digit GMT nerds. You guys like these watches quite a bit. You've got a Batman, Cole's got a Pepsi. It's always been an interesting thing for me to kind of see how they distance the Explorer 2 from the GMT Master, because I think the GMT Master is more core Rolex. I think it has been since, you know, it came out before the Explorer 2. And then I covered this a little bit in my magazine story, which covered the first several references in volume 9 of the magazine. You know, this was always the Explorer 2 was like the odd duck professional Rolex. You know, maybe a Cellini would be even further out. Maybe a Yachtmaster in many ways could be further out from the core. But if you think of like the main band members, this is the in that boy band of the Rolex professional models, this is kind of the odd duck, the little bit of the outsider, the right?
Playing the triangle in the back corner, you know?
A triangle. He's the one that gets
exactly.
Or these in the photo, he's the one in the leather jacket that's not really looking at the camera.
Yeah,
right?
It's true. Yeah. You're right.
This isn't Timberlake. This isn't the core of the, it's something kind of ancillary, but I think there's a huge, for me, I love this watch. I love a white dial sport watch. I love its connection to mountaineering. Of course, that's not exactly where it was designed. It was almost designed for the opposite, to go into caves. But I love that it became this kind of mountaineer's watch, Edvisters, and these backgrounds. And I have a 16570, which is a, you know, now two generations back, the one that would have ended in 2011 when it was a 39 millimeter, 40 millimeter watch with a great GMT movement. And of course, unlike a GMT Master, you're doing two time zones, not three, or not the possibility of three, because you don't really have the ability to do, say, like active UTC offset, which is what the rotating bezel on a GMT Master gets to you. What do you guys think of this? Like, let's go back to 2011 when they launched the 42 millimeter 216570. Where did you guys, do you guys remember that when it came out? I remember being at, I wasn't at Basel yet, but I remember covering it at the time.
I do not remember that era in time. I don't even know what I was doing in my own life, let alone.
Close somewhere in Southeast Asia. Something, just, yeah. Just fishing. It wasn't that concerned for whatever was happening in central Switzerland.
Yeah, true.
How about you, John?
I mean, I remember it vaguely. I'd remember the bump up in size was like the biggest part of the news. And also the kind of like more the callback to the original Explorer 2 with the kind of like the floating hands. I remember these details a little bit, but I can't say I remember it super well. It was, you know, it was a decade ago.
You were at Watch Time magazine, yeah? You were in the industry.
Yeah, yeah, right?
No, where was I? I was at Wristwatch magazine.
Yeah.
Oh, cool. Okay. So, I mean, this was a big departure. So we start back at the 1655. Now you have a very strange watch that arguably doesn't look that similar. They both have steel bezels, but they had a different handset. You know, we had a non kind of Mercedes style handset when the watch first came out and was available in a black dial, but you had the big orange GMT hand. And the idea was not so much to track a second time zone, but you could get a very quick indication on AM, PM, which is the idea was someone could go into a dark environment and know that, in this case, caving, believe it or not, was the impetus for this design, spelunking, the geological study of caves and the recreation of going into caves. One of the weirdest impetuses to launch an entire new model that has now lasted for like 50 years. But it's an interesting because very quickly, they kind of made it more Rolex-y. After the 1655, we go to the 16550, which is kind of where we established the design we have these days, where it starts to feel more Rolex, and it's where we have a white dial on a professional model watch.
Which doesn't exist elsewhere, or does? One or two white dial Explorer.
There's a white dial Daytona.
A Daytona, yeah, of course, yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah, Daytona, of course, yeah. I mean, there was GMT Master, right?
Supposedly, mm-hmm.
Supposedly, yeah.
So it is interesting. So let's talk about that transition a little bit more.
Like, yeah, so now you have a proper GMT, independently adjustable local jumping movement, which allows you to change time zones while keeping the GMT hand at a reference zone and referencing the 24-hour bezel around. This is where we started to see them at about 39 millimeters, drilled lugs, black or white dial, and they were immediately connected with a sort of more casual thing than going into caves. We're seeing, you know, famous skiers, you know, even volcanic studying scientists. Like, it wasn't just caving. There's not that anything that casual with volcanic sciences, but you know, it became something a little bit more of the 80s with the 16550, and that's kind of where my love. I mean, my dream watch would be an early 1655. It's one of my favorite vintage Rolexes. But I see them as that's almost its own thing. And for me, the Explorer 2 genuinely starts when you get the white dial, the red GMT hand, stuff like that.
And there's also a cream dial. Is that right? That's not how it's patinaed. There actually was a cream dial produced for a short amount of time in that era, right? This is kind of an off-white.
Not my understanding. It's my understanding that the early white dials, they're called panna cottas, and they aged very quickly to have a creamier color. And then later in the 1655, you have ones that still had an older version of loom that ages a very rich. And that was kind of where I started for a 16550. And I ended up with the next generation, and actually right at the end of the next generation, which has the 3186. So the most modern generation at the time in, say, 2007, 2008, 2009 of their GMT movement. Same, which would be in the very end of the 16710 and then the start of the six-digit GMT Masters like John's.
I gotta say, I'm not an expert. I love the Polar Explorer. Love it.
Yeah, me
I think
too.
It's a super cool watch, and obviously I'm a GMT guy, so you have to like the Polar Explorer or any, you know, GMT model. But I didn't know that there were so many permutations. I mean, it should be obvious, right? I know the only thing in my mind is the long stick GMT hand that's red changing over to the bright orange Frecciani style.
Yeah, so 2011, they ended the 40 millimeter model, which we talked about, and they went to this new version, which informs the brand new version that John got to see. And here they really tried to blend a little bit of classic, even 1655 elements with the big Frecciani style orange hand and the way that they color the hands so that the loom kind of floats for the black dial. The thing that has always gotten me, and it persists to today, is I have a few favorites. I love the white dial, like I've mentioned. And then the other thing that I love, and I love it on Rolex, I love it on 5270 Pateks, is where you have a light colored dial and genuinely dark markers. So with a 5270, these are black onyx markers. The level of contrast is really gorgeous and it can still be shiny. And with a 16570, the polar, you have the surrounds on the loom plots, its applied markers are like jet black, as are the hands. And for me, that's what does it. If I see a white dial watch with white metal markers, they lose me pretty quickly. It's that combination. They hit the little details really nicely.
Yeah, absolutely right. I mean, when you try to do like a white metal hand on a white dial, I mean, I've seen it with some watches recently. I don't need to name them, but it's like the whole legibility just becomes a huge issue. But on your watch, James, the hands and the markers have more of a matte quality to them, right, than the watch that succeeded it, right?
It's not that I think that they're less polished. There's just less metal. The hands are much smaller. The markers are much smaller. On this one, you in Rolex, guys, this is where you get into little arguments. Supercase maxi dial. So in this case, that you got both kind of in the 216570. So with those ones, you had bigger kind of the proportions changed. I think they lost some of the subtlety, but it is a much sportier expression. And as their watches, like you look at the progression of Rolex has been towards a more sporty sort of thing with the professional models lately. And I think it fits. And I'm not a fan of the 6-digit generations just because of the 42 millimeter case. There's something perfect in the 5 digits for me. Same with a 14060M versus a sub C. I'd rather go M even with the aluminum bezel. I just like the size. I like the fact that you could still get drilled lugs if you go back far enough. I didn't on my Explorer 2. But there's a lot of charm in them. But Rolex has to change. And typically they do these kind of glacial changes. And I think that's kind of what we see going from the 216570 to the 22 series, the one that you saw, John. So John, why don't you break down some of, I think we've given enough background and rambling of reference numbers for the one that you theoretically, and we'll get to this conversation as well, the one that you could theoretically buy at retail today, what differentiates it from the previous? Because if you don't know Rolex, they look identical.
Well, okay. So, I mean, there are some minute changes on the dial, which we can talk about in a little bit, but I think the main thing that struck me when looking at this watch was the narrower lugs, which had been talked about. The lug width on the previous model was 21. That's now increased to 22 millimeters. And what that allows is for, you know, a larger bracelet to occupy that space in between them. And I think that, you know, this combination, this new relationship between the lugs, which are narrower, and the bracelet, which is wider, is a little bit more elegant, in my opinion. I wouldn't say this is a watch that wears like a cuff by any means. This is not an Octo Finissimo, but I think it's better for a 42 millimeter Rolex. That was just kind of my gut feeling when I put the watch on for the first time. And then, of course, the other major change is the upgrade to the Caliber 3285, which is, you know, Chronergy Escapement, 70 hours of power reserve. I mean, I think it's an objectively better movement. So, but, you know, what's interesting with this watch is that it really, you know, it's Rolex has stayed with the 42 millimeter size. It's the same thickness. It wears pretty much the same. The comparison has to be with the 42 millimeter version. I think, you know, trying to take this watch and then compare it back to the watch that you wear doesn't really make sense.
It's been too long.
Yeah, it's been too long.
It's not the same Rolex. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, for me, the movement is interesting because there's a footnote that has already come up already. It's been months since this watch announced. So people have had lots of time to chat about it. And Rolex heads have been buying them. People who are well-connected certainly have them. If you go on the Rolex forum, they're there. And I found a lot of really interesting posts of people saying, like, people who have owned both of the 42 millimeter versions, give me the feeling. What's the difference? And a lot of it's like, oh man, if you've got the 2011, just, you're fine. It's great. They've made a few changes. This one wears a little bit better, but not like in a huge way. A lot of people saying that if you like to change straps, it's nice to have 22 versus 21 millimeter, which of course makes perfect sense. But then other people will lament the change in the hands, where now it's a kind of white gold on the black dial model, and it doesn't have the same sort of floating effect, which they tried to pull from the original. And then the last thing that people bring up is the fact that now the 216570 is seven, so the one from 2011, that's the only watch to have used Rolex's 3187 movement.
That's right, yeah.
But one movement for one watch, which is not something Rolex does, even with... Let's, if we stick with GMT Masters, 16710s had 3185s, and then very briefly at the end, and these are the ones that people like to collect right now, 3186s, and same with my Explorer 2. That 16570, most of them had 3185s. And then for longer than the 16710, there was a window of time, a couple years, where they were making them with the updated movement. And Rolex does this, where they sometimes blend movements mid-generation. And it makes sense. It's whatever they can produce, whatever they think is the best. Rolex will always do what they believe to be the absolute best decision for the watch. Not for its collectability, not for its necessarily its a consumer or like collector appeal. It's a consumer product, and they try and make it the best possible. And they're very open about that element. You know, it's an interesting thing to kind of compare and contrast the two, because there's so many similarities. And then people who seem to have owned both have feelings about the fact that the new one has an anti-reflective layer on the inside of the crystal that kind of makes the whole dial feel sharper.
Yeah.
Mm. And I kind of understand that. You know, Rolex, bless their heart, they're using flat crystals. I love it. Easier to photograph, you know, less damage, less distortion, all that sort of stuff. You know, where do you guys land between, say, the black or the white in the new generation?
For me, white all the way. It's just my preference, of course.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I think the white is has become kind of what I think of when I think of the Explorer too. You know, certainly is a modern one.
And the white with the orange is awfully cool.
Yeah, it really is.
Even in a size that like doesn't immediately make me want to sell the one I have and upgrade, it is very cool. And I like the way they look. I like both versions quite a bit. I'm really a sucker for that bezel, because it's Rolex, but it's so not at the same time. And it's usable. You know, I don't, like a Daytona, I wouldn't use the tachymeter bezel.
You remember, right? A lot of people were speculating that they were actually going to put a ceramic bezel on.
Yeah. And it was people, you know, taking dark images and brightening them way up and seeing like a something of a shine. And I think that ended up being maybe the slight polish bevel they put now on the edge of the bezel, which is a really beautiful thing if you do photograph the watch or any Explorer 2 that has it. But yeah, people definitely thought there was going to be a move to ceramic. And I don't know, that level of contrast, especially on the white dial, I'm not sure it would work. I'm not saying it wouldn't. You know, I'd have to do some Photoshops or whatever, or check somebody else's Photoshops. But what do you guys think? Do you think that at this point you should have a ceramic bezel on a watch of this price versus, let's keep in mind, people who may not know, the steel bezel on these has an outwardly radial finishing, which takes a scratch and will show it forever. I love the way it looks, but the first scratch is ugly. The 50th scratch is red.
I think, no, just because you can put ceramic in on the even the sub bezel, whatever, doesn't mean you should, to be honest. Like, ceramic is, I don't know, I'm a bit of a purist, of course, but I don't know, like, just putting ceramic on something like this for the sake of doing that, nah, not, it's just not right.
You know, I think a ceramic bezel is great for like a Daytona or a GMT. It's that, you know, in combination with the sapphire crystal has saved me probably from a few doorknobs and door jams since I bought the watch. However, like, you know, knocking this into a stalagmite or a stalactite in a cave might not yield the same kind of result if you had a ceramic bezel.
Those take a long time to build, John. Yeah. I hope no one's knocking into any slag. Those are thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of years. You know?
Yeah.
Since its start back in 1865, Zenith has become one of the world's preeminent watch manufacturers, and the brand has been a player in many of watchmaking's greatest moments, including the historic flight over the English Channel, the creation of the first automatic chronograph movement in 1969, and even a record-setting leap from more than 24 miles above the Earth's surface. Using exclusively in-house calibers, including the iconic El Primero, the 100th of a second resolution of the Defy 21 line, and the universal charm of the new Chronomaster Sport, Zenith has established itself at the nexus of style and genre-defining watchmaking. Capturing these accolades in a warmly 70s package, the Chronomaster Revival El Primero A385 offers the best of Zenith's modern capabilities wrapped in the wrist presence of an easy-wearing, classic chronograph. With an automatic high-beat El Primero 400 movement, the A385 is a faithful homage to the golden era of sports chronographs, complete with a 37mm steel case, a smoked brown gradient dial, and your choice of a leather strap or a full steel bracelet. Priced from $7,900, it's a modern chronograph with true style, substance, and collector appeal. Click the link in the show notes or visit shop.hodinkee.com to see for yourself. And now, back to the show.
And here's what I will say. I wish they redid the 1655 or the, you know, the original Explorer 2. That would be the watch for me.
Yeah, I think that wouldn't be a very Rolex-y thing to do, John, you figure? To get, like, to do an actual reverse referential model. Sometimes you get one color, you know, on the Sea Dweller, you get the red. Now on this, you get an orange kind of old school style hand. But to do an actual throwback model doesn't feel super them. Not to my knowledge for the brand anyways.
Yeah, I don't think they do that. I think that's much more the playground of Tudor these days. But, you know, Rolex, like you said, will call back certain elements, but they will never, or I'm not going to say what they'll do, but I've never known them to completely go back and just remake something.
The new hot thing is, what will the new Milgauss look like, right? And a lot of people are saying that we're going to see a lot of the old Milgauss. So who knows on that front, but... Here's a question for both of you, and especially you, John. Actually, James, I mean, this is really your wheelhouse too, but all right, they just, you know, trimmed up the case, all this stuff. All right, what now does the next iteration of this watch look like? How much more can you do? Like, how much more can you actually push this design in any direction? I really don't know.
Yeah, I think the next one, the signifier for me, because you always have to like try and get your bearings with a different Rolex's progression. If the Sea Dweller drops off of 43, let's say they go back to 40 for the Sea Dweller, then I think we could see the next generation of the Explorer 2 come down in size. If they're refining the thing to feel more comfortable and proportionally proper on wrist for a larger sport watch, then yeah, I'd be with John. I'd be surprised. But I also think it could be 10 years. Like 10 years ago, I was just getting into this. I don't like watches have changed a lot in 10 years. Tastes towards watches have changed. Interest in watches is, you know, it's 10x what it was. And if that's not the same in 10 years, every company, including Rolex, will be making different decisions than they have been.
Well, I will say this. I mean, now that we're seeing two 42 millimeter references in a row, I think it's unlikely to see a return to 40 in the way that we saw a return to 36 with the Explorer 1. I feel like we're firmly in this, you know, oversized 42 millimeter territory. Beyond that, it's hard to say. I feel like, you know, polar dial is for sure here to stay, along with black. I don't see the black going away.
Yeah.
In terms of design progression.
Speaking of change and 10 years ago and so forth, one interesting thing to note about the polar is that it has popped. And I'm going to speak on behalf of the entire Hodinkee audience and say that you are a singular market mover, James, and you have made this watch really, really expensive. I'm kidding. I'm joking. But it has gotten more expensive.
I've definitely been, when I bought this watch, it was like one of the cheap sport watches from Rolex. And I bought it used at that point, and it was not an expensive watch by anyone's measure, inside or outside of Rolex. And today they've gone way up in price, like everything else has. And I think the fact that we're seeing 216570, so again, the 2011 model, the earliest of the 42 millimeter sizes, we're seeing those were unavailable for the last couple of years or difficult to get, whereas they had kind of been the one that was in store. You'd go in, there'd be a two-tone Datejust, there'd be a black Explorer 2, and they'd scoff at you when you asked for a Rolex. Now you go in, there's nothing, depending on where you are and what your connections are and that sort of thing. And honestly, I feel like that's something we've talked about 50 times in the history of this show, that it's hard to buy a Rolex. It's like it's a little bit of a cliche at this point. We get it. It's tough to buy it. List price on this is $85.50. So it's a little bit under the price of a sub no date. And I think for that kind of money, if you can get one, I still think it's an eminently cool Rolex for people who don't feel the distinct need to have a Daytona or a sub.
Or a GMT.
And I've been in that camp forever. I saw this watch when I was first getting into watches, getting into mountaineering and adventuring and all that kind of stuff. And then I eventually saw a photo of one on a Grenado, and it kind of set me on a path that, you know, that has kind of defined my appreciation for Rolex in a big level.
Yeah. I just think, you know, what a cool, useful watch this is, you know, with the locally set hour, and thinking, I hadn't considered that it costs less than a no date sub. Like, to me, this is almost like a no brainer, actually. I mean, if you can get it, right?
Yeah, it's always everything you got to say. Like, everybody listening, if we say, oh, but this is a good deal, like, I know, there's an asterisk on it. They're hard watches to buy. I genuinely believe it won't always be like this. It wasn't like this, you know, previously for the course of the brand. They were exclusive things that were available at retail with some patience. Now that patience level has kind of changed, and we have the introduction of this whole flipping market. That could be a topic for a different show, absolutely. I do like to focus on this. You know, if we look at the whole line and we assume that they're available in stores, or maybe you wait a couple months or something and you could get one for the we'll call it the core professional line. What is the Explorer 2's place these days? Who buys this over, aside from me, who buys this over a sub or a Daytona, or in both of your cases, the beloved you know, one of the classics from the brand, the GMT Master.
Contrarians.
Yeah. It's just, or it's somebody who it's, I don't think this is necessarily someone's first Rolex in many cases. If it is, it's someone who is like, just like really drawn to the combination of the white dial and an orange hand on a Rolex, you know?
Yep. I believe it. And hey, again, at 22 millimeters, a little easier to put on a NATO. It's one that I'm curious about, you know, like I said, right from the top, this is a watch I'm very curious about. And I'd like to get some wrist time with it or whatever we describe that. So maybe I can sometime in the future. I think this is this remains this weirdo, charming sort of, especially with the white dial, because almost everything else is black and commonly seen in black. And for me growing up, you always saw subs or watches that were pretending to be subs, fakes, or even just other brands' version of the Submariner. And that saturation made the watch feel a little bit less special in terms of something that I would try and buy and save up for. I kind of immediately wanted a Sea Dweller back when they were this kind of cool version of a sub and not this bigger, entirely different sort of thing. And then when I found this watch and kind of found its connection to a variety of you know, kind of big names in alpinism and this weirdo cave history. And then, you know, back in the day, everyone's got this story. I've got 10 of them. But yeah, I should have bought a 1655 when they were $5,000-$6,000. And you know, not as dangerous to buy now if you're, you know, if you're not an expert on little dial changes and stuff like that. I'm glad that they're still continuing it because it is one of those things where I think they could say like 50 years, you know, we're done. And maybe, you know what, maybe that's what it'll be in 6 or 7 years. The Explorer 2 will be over.
So get one now. Enjoy it now if you can.
Very, very stable purchase in the market these days. All right, so what do you guys say we transition to something that's both commercially and retail available and considerably less expensive, but I think might actually appeal to the same sort of person in some way?
You had me at less expensive.
Let's do it.
All right, let's do it. So John, following John's lovely story with the 226570, Cole wrote a piece for Entry Level, which is a series we've got going where it kind of covers the most inexpensive model offered by a brand. And we've done some interesting ones, a Breitling one and such. And I think I've got a couple of these booked to write in the new year. I'm looking forward to digging into it because it is an interesting way to think about a brand. You guys know this, like when you cover watches, you tend to cover it at the same angle that their PR interfaces or their ads interfaces, because that's the watch that people know about. And sometimes you find a dark horse or an interesting thing, but few times would a brand put a lot of their money, their promotional money, behind their most entry-level watch, because obviously their gross margin should be higher on a more expensive watch, at least conceivably, until you get into very complicated things. And with this kind of series, we're looking at entry-level watches, and it's not entry-level brands. It's the entry point to a brand, right? Which is kind of a fun way of looking at it. And Cole, you made one for the Marathon Navigator. Why don't you start with... So I don't have to do all the explaining or the Canadian angle. Why don't you start with a little bit about Marathon? Because my guess is there's some people who don't know the brand.
Sure. Yeah. So you mentioned the Dark Horse watch. I think this is, you can even think of this as a Dark Horse brand. It's a brand that does not have, well, okay, now they have a minimal retail operation. They are mainly a government contract brand. So they produce watches based on government contracts for specific purposes. I did the only time it's been covered on Hodinkee is the 36 millimeter MSAR, which is not the entry level. Great watch.
It's a great watch.
But I think that kind of opened
also
up.
A great white dial.
It is. Yeah. That's a good point, actually. Great white dial. So Marathon, a bit of a, you know, a black sheep in the whole world of collectible watches because of this, that they've never invested money into getting the word out to collectors that they produce watches. Although they do actually produce collectible watches beyond their core watches. They produce special editions with the Air Force insignia or let's say US government or for special units and so forth. So that's who Marathon is. And it is Canadian. So you are Canadian. So you should speak to the Canadian-ness of the watch because it's right down the street from you, really.
Yeah, not far at all. And I think they're a fascinating company. These are really like genuine modern tool watches. They're not super expensive. That's how they get the government contracts and that sort of thing. I've owned a TSAR and a GSAR, basically the same watches at 41 millimeters, one with a high torque quartz and one with a automatic movement. And, you know, when I first came across the brand, it was because they were doing a chronograph that had been not issued, but had been contracted for the Canadian Coast Guard. Mm. So it was built to a specification for the Canadian Coast Guard, and they were kind of too big for me.
So the JSAR?
The CSAR.
Oh, CSAR, okay.
Oh, JSAR. JRC. I don't remember.
You know, it could be one of them.
The naming thing is a little bit tough.
Yeah.
But they were a little bit too big for me, but I remember realizing not only did they make other watches, but they made kind of more simple dive watches that use tritium tube illumination. So if you haven't had that, you need to buy a watch with tritium tube if you haven't experienced it. It's kind of the best lume that there is out there. It's little tiny glass tubes filled with decaying radioactive material that glows kind of permanently, pretty brightly for about a decade.
Yeah, the half-life is about a decade.
Yeah, you don't have to charge it in the light or anything. It just goes.
No, so if you've ever had a watch from Ball that's tritium, they use a very high level of tritium and have helped that company kind of iterate new colors and brighter specs. This is more the military level. This would be common to gun sights in some scenarios, to luminous pips on compasses. It's a tool spec thing. It's not unsafe. It's my understanding the type of radiation that these let go of is beta radiation, and it doesn't penetrate a case or the crystal or any of that kind of thing. So they're safe on wrist. They glow permanently. If you haven't, Tracer is another one where you can get like a tritium tube illumination watch for a few $100s, and they make a lovely little watch. I really like these. I've owned, like I said, the kind of two versions of their 41 millimeter dive watch. But the Navigator is something else. It is the entry point to the brand, or an entry point to the brand.
Right.
It's a plastic case by any other terms. It's a nylon resin case of some sort.
Yeah, that's exactly it. It's a nylon resin case with a bezel that actually works. So That's interesting how we can, you know, you think about a plastic case watch, there are very few with operating bezels because it takes, obviously, the track for the bezel must be metal. I haven't taken one apart and I really should, but that mechanism must be metal. So it must be metal inlaid into the plastic there to make that work. But
some sort of a seat or a channel.
Yeah, exactly.
This is a plastic case watch. Does it have the tritium tubes for illumination in the plastic case?
Yeah.
Wow. That's an interesting combination.
It's a kind of a strange case. I'll explain the case first. I'll go through each element quickly. The case. The case is actually asymmetrical. On the right side, the case bulges out and forms a crown guard. So, you know, Rolex, it comes out like a beak of a bird or something. This does not. The whole side of the case is circular, but is bulged out to protect the crown.
Right. So think Hamilton Pioneer, the recent stuff from Hamilton Pioneer, or before that, like a Benriss Type 1.
Exactly. Number two, case material, like we talked about, is a polymer. The polymer comes in two colors, black or desert tan khaki, sort of an earth tone brown. Dial is black with tritium indices, and it's built to mil-spec. It's your Arabic numeral on the dial. It's the quintessential military look. And that's kind of the watch, and it has a bezel, but there is something very interesting about the bezel, which James, being the go-to GMT second time zone, so forth, guy, what do you have to say about that? This is kind of the most interesting feature of the watch.
Yeah, so it's a 12-hour bezel, which was common for a window of time, and I think through the late 70s, maybe. And then it kind of disappeared for a while. I always joke around that it's like a CMT, cheap mean time, because it gives you a complication with no additional cost. So you have 12 hours on the bezel, and you basically rotate the bezel. And you can look up a guide. I'll put it in the show notes. It's really, really entry-level stuff. But you rotate the bezel to reflect the offset of your time zone from another. Put the offset. So let's say there's 3 hours difference between New York and LA. You'd put 3 at 12. And then you simply use your single hour hand and read the hour off of the bezel. It couldn't be easier. It couldn't cost less. You still get a pip. So if you want to time a pizza or a whatever, you can. So you get kind of multiple uses out of it. I think they're super handy. I've modded Seikos to have them. Makes them instantly a great travel watch that still flies way under the radar. I can include, obviously we'll put this in the show notes, but yeah, there's a specific military complication or qualification for these watches. 41 millimeters. You get them on a NATO. They have drilled lugs. $385, give or take. Yeah, not that expensive. And they make them in date and no date. So you get that choice. And then they're like with a lot of Marathon's watches, they're sterile dial. With some of them, you get a choice whether you want it to say Marathon or not. And some might even have an insignia. My TSAR had like the full engraved case back for its military order. That's a watch I kind of wish I had kept. You know, it was probably like $400 or $500 at the time. I probably wrote it and flipped it, which I was doing at the time to have stuff to write about. But yeah, these are fascinating. I've always been kind of keyed into them. I love the idea of a field watch. They are kind of like, you could almost believe like if they needed a modern Benrus type one, type two, that sort of thing. And of course those watches were reborn, but probably not to the extent that a CIA operator in the Southeast would be wearing them. But you could almost believe seeing these on the wrist of someone who's using them like in a professional capacity. They have that vibe.
Yeah, and they are pilot's watches. So that's the interesting thing about it. It's not a dive
nor
watch.
A field watch.
It's actually designed for pilots. Yeah, nor a field watch. It's a pilot's watch, but a much different form. So you can go read the story, read a little bit more about them. But I think my main takeaway would be take a look at Marathon. Just it's always been out, you know, on the sidelines for the main portion of watch enthusiasts, but it shouldn't be. And I think the reason is because they've never invested in marketing. But
yeah, well, that and for some time they were a little bit on the harder side to buy.
They were, yeah. You really had to jump through hoops. Yeah.
Now they have a shop. You can see what's in store. And also, don't be a complete jabroni. If you buy a Navigator, get the button compass that slides onto the NATO. Come on.
Yes, 100% agreed.
It's a little navigating compass, and the heading ring is luminous. So you can charge it with a flashlight like you would for a dive compass. And it's $25. Like, what are you doing?
Yeah. You literally would be a jabroni wandering around not knowing where you're going. But this will easily solve that problem. So don't be a jabroni and just do it.
Even if you don't put it on the strap. They're so fun. I do really like these watches. And I like the vibe in general. And of course, the same goes for the 226570. Guys, thanks so much for coming on. It was a treat to see you both. John, like we said, it's great to have you back as a proud dad. That's awesome.
Thanks, James. Good to be back.
Likewise. Always fun talking about exploring and navigating.
You got to be able to do both or you're lost for sure. All right. If you're listening and enjoying the show, please tell a friend, leave a comment if you think we missed something. And otherwise, you know, we'll chat to you in a few days. Thanks for listening.